Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Grandstand cricket.
With a splendid innings for New Zealand, but they are all out for 372.
Another test is done and dusted. Now it's time for some post-match parlay with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins. The Final Word with ABC Grandstand.
Welcome to the Final Word podcast at the end of the second test in this 15-16 summer. I'm Adam Collins. I'm a writer and a broadcaster with ABC Grandstand. And with me is, as always, poet, podcaster, writer and agenda setter, Jeff Lemon in Perth. Jeffrey, how are you?
Oh, pretty good down here, the western side of the country, still enjoying the secession conversations and general angst towards the East Coast, and I now feel like I'm genuinely part of the other side.
I miss you, Jeff. It's been like a total 2 days since we've seen each other. This is very unusual for Jeff and me, if you're listening at home. We spend an inordinate amount of time together, and 2 days apart, I don't know what I'm going to do without you.
Yeah, just trapped in a small room watching other people play cricket. You know, that's the way the relationship works. Whatever crutches you need to prop things up, I guess.
Let's crack on. It was an interesting test match in Perth. I wouldn't say an overly stimulating one after the first day. It was one of those test matches where I think it's fair to assume that there was only really two results possible after the first hour and a half. Now, the test was effectively over at lunchtime. There was really no way New Zealand were going to come back from that. It's kind of frustrating.
Yeah, it was frustrating, but it was also, I mean, there was a grandness in statistical terms. You're watching these innings pile up and these partnerships falling and you're thinking, you know, this is momentous historical stuff. But at the same time, there is that feeling that it's not so much of a challenge as you wanted. You know, you want your batsman who makes 300 odd to really have to work for it and not just sort of stand there and club away. But at the same time, there was some brilliant stuff happening out there from Warner and Ross Taylor and Kane Williamson all gave us a show.
Sure, and we'll come back to them. But, you know, there's that usual cycle in Perth where the curator comes out a couple of days before a test match, says it'll be a fearsome 70s, 80s, 90s style pitch, and then inevitably it's docile, there's a ton of runs, and it really is underwhelming. And I think that's something that everyone, players, administrators, coaches, the like, members of the media, were in unison for in this test. I don't know, are we ever going to see a situation where we go to Perth and it'll truly be, you know, spitting off a length anymore? Or do we just need to accept the new reality that Perth is just like any other flat track in Australia?
Well, I think you can get that answer to that question by, you know, the nature of the curator when he came up to the ABC box and was being asked these questions. And he had a level of resignation where he was just saying, well, you know, I'd like it to be doing that as much as anyone else, but it doesn't. And he can't make it do that. And he's got some ideas about how he might, and he might get there over a few years. But, you know, maybe it's gone. If the curator's at a loss, what are we supposed to do about it? How are we supposed to know anything? I don't know about root systems and decomposing moisture structures and, you know, what cracks and what doesn't. I wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah, Dirk Nannis, a colleague from the commentary team, was saying they should literally cut the track out of the practice wickets, which he reckons is the most dangerous and hostile wicket he's ever batted on, and take it into the middle. And he's like, yeah, I'd love to, mate, but not going to happen. So, but it made the toss critical. Like I said at the start, the test was over within a couple of hours, principally because... Yeah. David Warner got going from the get-go, and like, it's just incredible, that bloke. I mean, a couple of months ago when he got made the vice-captain, I think we all collectively went fair dinkum, like, this guy could be the Australian captain if Steve Smith goes down. And now it seems like there was never any other way. Like, this is just the most logical appointment ever made.
He's loving it, isn't he? Like, he's got that kind of, you know, World War II fighter pilot moustache going. And you could just see that he could see himself in that role, you know, standing out there on a runway somewhere, the Battle of Britain, with a leather jumpsuit on and just being ready for some derring do. You know, he digs it. He likes being in charge. And he has, in his own Warner-esque way, acted like a guy who's in charge. He's had some seniority, you know. He's been,
and it was always that thing about batting. It was always that batting all day thing. I don't know how many times we spoke about this in the past. You said, you know, it was like the analogy you used. It might be your metaphor. You always correct me on this, Jeff. Is that it was like a robotic fighting arms to a timber wolf. If you ever were to bat an entire day, this hypothetical, mythical idea of David Warner, and now he's batted for over 200 balls in consecutive Test matches. He seems this is what Bradman used to do, bat for an entire day. Thus, he made as many runs in a day's cricket as we've seen since Bradman in 1934. Yep. And it wasn't like he was slogging. Like, the David Warner we grew up with, or not grew up with, but we first were accustomed to, was hitting over cow, 2020 quintessential white ball player. But this was precise batting. This was accumulation, turning the strike over. He said that the secret of the innings was taking one when one was there and letting them set the field back. It's just a completely different player. And 15 tons in 45 Test matches, that puts him fourth on the all-time list. And Clyde Walcott, I should add, is 44 tests for 15 tons. So he's only just behind him. And then you've got the big two of Bradman and then the black Bradman, George Headley. Mm. So like, this is an esteemed company, isn't it, in now, Jeff?
Absolutely. And I think Smithy's just nudged ahead of him in that list now. I think Smith's up to the 2.9s because he got that 100 in the second innings. So he's got his 1,200 from 35 tests or whatever it is. So, you know, they're kind of dueling for this ratio. You know, obviously they're playing on slightly easier pitches than Messrs. Headley and Walcott and Bradman were. But
it's funny because he's actually done this thing where he set out in the last couple of games, he wanted to bat more balls and make a double 100. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what Steve Smith was saying 6 months ago. He wanted to make a 200. It was a real objective. Yep. And it's like these guys need to keep reassessing their goals over and over again. But New Zealand have been on the receiving end of it. Just to talk about them for a moment. Modern cricket, the lack of preparation. I know they played a couple of two-day games and that abandoned game in Blacktown. But, I mean, how do we overcome this? They're not going to have long tours. And landing in the country, coming out underdone, they didn't really hit their straps until 7 days into the second test match, so the second day of the second test match, and it was all a bit too little too late, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but even New Zealand getting three tests is unusual from the Australian side. You know, our mob have tended to make it hard for New Zealand, squeeze them in two tests, you know, 4 years ago was the last time they were here. They barely get a gig in Australia, and it's sort of, it's only since the World Cup and they started to get a bit more attention and people started to like their style of play that suddenly we're saying, well, we should be playing New Zealand more, and, you know, it would be interesting. But, look, I don't think it's not so much the prep but the pitches as well. Like, them having to front up in Brisbane and then in Perth and bowl first on two just absolutely garbage tracks that were just batting tracks all match, you know, what are you going to do with that as a visiting bowling side? And it makes me think we should revisit this thing of this idea of maybe getting rid of the toss and, you know, letting the visiting team choose each match, or at least letting them choose in the first match and then alternating so that, you know, they get more choices through the series if it's an odd number of tests. Because it would have been so much more an interesting match if New Zealand had come out and batted first in Brisbane or in Perth.
Totally revolutionary. It doesn't really affect Kane Williamson, though. He's a freak. We're so lucky at the moment. We've got Williamson, Coley, Smith and Root acting as some sort of Fab Four in world cricket. They're all 25 or 26. They're all plundering runs, making tons for laughs. Williamson is kind of boring on one level in as far as he's so compact and he plays such a straightforward game of cricket. But it's also nourishing watching someone who plays the game in that traditional classic stylist way. Oh, I could watch him bat all day. He's phenomenal.
It's absolutely ridiculous. He arrived in this country with a test average of 45.7. Two tests later, it's 49.26. Because he's added a couple of big hundreds there, another half century in Brisbane, and not out in Perth. And he's just piled them up. But he just looks beautiful to watch. You know, he's one of these, like, I don't get excited about every batsman who scores big runs. So some of them just, you know, say watching Matthew Hayden, for instance, it's kind of left me cold. Like, yeah, he'd score a mountain of runs and people loved him. But I just didn't really enjoy the aesthetics of watching him go, you know, for whatever reason, whatever
loved
subjective
the flat,
reason.
Love the flat track Matthew Hayden.
Yeah, well,
love
yeah,
just I mean, look, plundering blokes over their heads.
Love plundering runs in India as well, and played some impressive knocks in his time. But you know, I just didn't enjoy the feeling of watching him. Watching Kane Williamson, he's just perfect. He's just I think he missed times two balls in that 166, and one was the one that got him out, and one was a you know another sort of shovel to the onside from Johnson that you know that just. He hit hard into the ground and it dribbled away. Everything else, the timing, like his balance, his foot movement, his balance, he's completely still when he plays the shot and he just goes cover drive, straight drive, cut, mid-wicket, on drive. And that's basically yeah, like all he plays. And
there's
and
a big the sign around his neck saying, you shall not pass to other bowlers. Yeah. Like there's just no way through. He's not sneaking off. I know the Australian players love to talk about his inability to nick to slip and maybe there's something in that. I know he nicks behind to the keeper from time to time, but it seems to be that he doesn't have that vulnerability in his game that a lot of top order players do. He doesn't nick off early, simply put. Yeah. Doesn't nick to slip. So,
but he's also not the wall. Like, he comes out and actually plays shots and motors along, you know, strikes him at 60, 70, 80 in the innings and just gets going regardless of the match situation.
And it's this great redemption story from New Zealand as well, that being Ross Taylor, who's made the biggest score in the history of the game on Australian soil as a foreign player. It's hard to think that, as we said, a fairly docile game when you look at it as a whole that we saw a quite phenomenal record. We saw two really quite remarkable records if you consider that David Warner matched that Bradman stat from 1934 and then Taylor to knock off a record from 1903, our mate Tip Foster. You know how he did it? There was this great comment in the press conference after he made that 290 where he said the secret to his success was a couple of eye drops he put in before he batted because his eyes had glazed over, his leading eye, his left eye, had glazed over with some, I don't know what it would be, some sort of stigmatism or some such. And then that was the catalyst to him opening his eyes up and being able to see the ball properly again. And 290 runs for the better.
Jesus. Oh, well, you have to take a bucket of that stuff around with him from now on. Just
like the old magic spray.
Just start drinking it.
Remember when kids, the magic spray used to come out, Errol Alcott would run out onto the field. And that was enough to get any Australian player back at the peak of his powers again.
Absolutely. Do away with the sports drinks in the bottles. Let's just have those eye drops. Just hose them. You know, just put several litres of it through your body per day. Can't do any harm, surely.
And I wonder how many balls he actually saw. I mean, he saw a ton of balls and batted for 9.5 hours, but how many different new balls and versions of it? Like, Kookaburra are under an enormous amount of promotional pressure now, or reputational pressure, I should say. They've 15 balls in an entire test match. I've really never seen anything like that, Jeff. I think that's something that is now become a major talking point ahead of Adelaide. And it may have inoculated Adelaide somewhat with the pink ball test, which we'll come back to later. But if there were 15 ball changes in Adelaide next week without the context of what's happened in Perth this week, there'd be an absolute outcry, an uproar about it not being good enough. But
you would never see a day-night test again, I reckon. I honestly reckon. If you had that, you know, it'd be gone, which raises the conspiracy theories that maybe it was all a plot so that we could take the pressure off the pink ball.
Second conspiracy theory of the week. There's another good one we'll come back to later to do with Mitchell Starc.
Jet fuel does not melt pink cricket balls, Adam.
Well, you know.
You know what? Wake up, Sheeble.
The amount of time lost as well. Like you think about, we had a 17-minute delay during the test match, which will probably, those who are watching it will never forget. It was high farce at the Prindeville stand end when the sight screen wouldn't move from one side to the other. Nevertheless, there must have been a lot more time lost than 17 minutes across the course of the game through changes in balls. And that's been completely lost in the commentary, I think.
Yeah, well, massively. And, you know, it would have been pretty interesting if it came down to, you know, if New Zealand were 8 down sort of at the end of day 5 and a couple more overs might have made the difference. Would have been an interesting one with all the time lost out of the game.
There were some other excellent performances would have skipped through. Usman Khawaja, what terrible timing doing his left pinger running in the field after a second graceful 100. I mean, Simon Kadich on the call talked about needing to build momentum in your career as you go through, and that looked to just be the threshold that Khawaja had finally broken through after 5 years. And Steve Smith said that he's keeping the place warm, quote, at number three while he's away. But, oh, gee, you just hope that this isn't the sort of thing that stunts what's been a wonderful, I guess, restart to his career.
Yeah, he's had a lot of bad luck. He's been shunted about. You know, he's been one of a number of players who haven't got a consistent go from selectors over the last few years and maybe just should have been stuck with early on. But, you know, did his knee miss a year there. So you just hope that these runs of luck, you know, come to an end and these kind of players are able to get something going. But he looked.
I love that Brian.
He did look good. I'm not so sure about all the gushing over him because honestly, you know, it's a pretty easy way to come in, bat first, come in at one for absolutely heaps every innings, and just plunder something on a first day pitch. You know, he hasn't really faced down a lot of tough tired bowl, you know, tough fresh bowling or anything where the ball's doing anything. So you know, I'm not as excited on the Uzi front as everybody else seems to be.
But isn't it the aesthetics? Isn't it as much about the way he's compiled the runs as it is the totals he's made? I agree, they've been very favourable conditions, but I kind of dig the fact that Brian Lara is tweeting him, saying how well he's batting. I know they're mates and all the rest of it, but there is that similarity, of course, that stylish left-hander that drives stunningly down the ground. Like, it's hard not to be, you know, compelled by him. And the other really excellent performance for Australia, although it wasn't necessarily recognised in the numbers initially, at least, was Mitchell Stark's pace. And we'll come back to the chasm between he and Mitchell Johnson a bit later on when we talk about the great man and his retirement. But getting a ball over 161 kilometres an hour? Was it over 160 kilometres an hour?
160.4 was the alleged speed. But I'm gonna throw this out. There are a couple of people on the ABC call noticed this at the time. There was a point when New Zealand were bowling where they clocked Tim Southee at something like 146. Now, Tim Southee does not bowl at 146 kilometres an hour. Does not happen. And he would admit that himself. He's a 135 operator. Now, you know, what does it say? It doesn't really make me trust the timing. I'm sure Mitch Stark was bowling 150s. He was bowling very briskly, and it was a nice spell. But, you know, Roscoe Taylor just blocked out that alleged 160 ball with a casual forward defensive. And, as Brendan McCullum said, maybe you should ask Ross if he reckons it was 10k's an hour faster than anything else he faced that day.
As a kid growing up, you watch those videos that the national broadcast, not national broadcast, the broadcaster of our cricket, I won't mention who they are, would bowl Jeff Thompson in that competition back in the 70s. And you always see that ball that was a full toss, a hit middle stump out of the ground. And you think that when someone finally breaks the 100 mile an hour barrier, it'll break through a bat or something like that. And yeah, sure, Brendan McCullum lost the toe of his bat to an earlier Mitchell Stark Yorker, but that was like a 145 delivery. And yet, like you say, the 160, the alleged 160 kilometre an hour nut didn't look anywhere near as fearsome. So it's kind of underwhelming. I always hoped that it would be a ball that, would break the bat in half or something to that effect. But nevertheless,
you imagine it being something like out of a sports drink ad or something where the ball explodes in a giant cloud of smoke or something and, you know, like pterodactyls come down from the sky and pluck the batsman up and carry him away. You know,
now we're talking. This is what I'm talking about. You know, you get, this is exactly the imagery I had around 100 mile an hour barrier, which he fell just short of, I should add. He didn't quite get to 100 mile an hour.
It's 161 k's. It's got to have giant screaming eagles or like, you know, like that, the Mad Max kind of thing, like that death metal guitarist, like tied to the front of a truck, you know, with flames coming out of the guitar. Like that's what the 100 mile an hour ball's got to be.
I'll tell you when there was no flames coming out of the guitar, it was during the fifth morning when it was just slow going. And I know New Zealand bowled well, but gee, it was hard yakka when we knew that Australia needed quick runs in order to force a realistic result and being able to declare in such a fashion that New Zealand would chase it down. But 321 in 48 overs, it was beyond the wildest dreams in New Zealand. And then when the rain came, it just reinforced that. But Jeff, you were very critical of the Steve Smith declaration.
Yeah, I was. And, you know, some people hit back on that saying, oh, he's got every right to block New Zealand out of the series and retain the trophy and whatever. Look, I reckon, and I've got to say, I love Steve Smith as a batsman. You know, love him as a bowler, love him as a fielder, love him as a player. I don't think he's got the groove as a captain yet. And it's early days and maybe we should be a little generous, but if you're going into a home series against New Zealand, who for all that they're a good team, they're still a weaker team than Australia, or should be in home conditions. If you're going into a home series against them and your mindset is, I've got to retain the trophy, like I've got to aim for an even scoreline so we keep the trophy, you don't deserve the job. Like that is not how an Australian captain should be thinking. You should be thinking, win the test match, win it 2-0, and don't leave it up to Adelaide where anything could happen in a day-night test. Now, you know, they probably wouldn't have won if they'd set a more generous declaration, but you just never know. If you'd set them whatever it was, you know, they were already over 200 nearly at the start of the day. The lead was 190-odd. If you'd set them 260, 280 and given them 60 overs, you know, they probably would have had a go. And on that pitch where the odd one was keeping low and some of them were going off the seam, you might have got 3 or 4 wickets early, and then there would have been real pressure on and New Zealand would have been trying to survive and you might have been able to get the win. And I just think, I just want to see, it's not about, it has to be a contest, but I want to see teams trying to win. I want to see both teams trying to win.
Quite reasonable. The scathing critique of Jeff Lemon. I'm Adam Collins. This is the Final Word Podcast.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is the Final Word with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins, ABC Grandstand.
We've had 6 retirements in 7 test matches now. The team's really in transition. Now, we haven't had the same deep recession that we've had in 1984 when, of course, Lilly and Marsh and Chappell retired at the same time, or 2006 with Warne, McGrath and Langer, but this is a new challenge, and we talked about Steve Smith before. It's not going to be easy looking after one of the most inexperienced sides in modern memory.
It's not, but at least they've got a relatively easy kind of glide in. You know, New Zealand at home hasn't been a tough series so far. The West Indies will probably be less tough. You know, I don't want to preempt what the West Indies are going to bring to the table, but that's my feeling. That's the word on the street.
Oh, I saw them. I saw them in June when Australia over there. That's being generous. They will not be long Test matches.
So yeah, look, I don't know. Look, it doesn't seem to have that same level of portent, though. Like, yeah, a lot of players have gone, but they weren't necessarily players who were absolutely dominating their... You know, like, Michael Clarke was pretty average in the side for his last few test matches. Shane Watson wasn't setting the world on fire. You know, Chris Rogers was dependable in scoring, but, you know, so can other people be. Mitch Johnson wasn't at his best. You know, it's not like you're not losing Warne, McGrath sort of just after New Year's 2007, where they're actually still great players.
There have been thousands of words written and spoken about Mitchell Johnson in the last 48 hours, and we're going to add just a few more. It was just such a human story, the Mitchell Johnson story. It was very accessible, the idea of the superstar, then he faded, then he returned, and then he faded again. It's just one of those things that I think the Australian public never really fell out of love with Mitchell Johnson. Even when things were going poorly, I think there was this genuine affection for him, and I don't think we're ever going to forget that 13-14 Ashes series. That'll be held up in the same level as the Lilly and Thompson demolition jobs of the mid-70s. It was old-fashioned fast bowling, as a couple of writers noted through the week, and I think we're just very happy to have seen it. And Jeff, you talk about the Adelaide Test being the most incredible spell of fast bowling you've seen a couple of years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Like, and I'm not even exaggerating when I say I was sitting in the press box at Adelaide and I was flinching when he bowled. Like, it was coming down that quickly. It was smashing through batsmen. It was rattling stumps. It was, you know, bounces at the head. He was terrifying. He was absolutely terrifying. And he basically just had this perfect 3 months where he played those 5 tests against England, then 3 against South Africa, 22 wickets in the 3 tests against South Africa, 37 against England. So he took nearly 20% of his career wickets in that 3 months, which is an incredible thing to consider.
Absolutely. And to finish on 4th on the wicket tally list, you would have scoffed at that.
It's sad to see him go.
Galloping along to Adelaide in terms of who's been selected for that squad. Pattinson is the direct replacement for Johnson as the fast bowler. So Pattinson's an interesting one. We'll deal with him first in isolation. He's been brought into the squad after several injuries and not quite looking the part with the white ball in England, but having a really strong start to the Shield season. I'm a bit surprised by it. I thought they might make him wait an entire Shield season and prove his fitness over the long term, given that Adelaide's a notoriously challenging place to bowl fast and coming back into the side with added responsibility. Do you think he'll get the nod, or Siddle will?
Siddle definitely will. He has to. Surely he has to. Like, they need that control on an Adelaide pitch. You know, they need an old head. I mean, it would be an absolute injustice to Peter Siddle. He's been waiting. You know, he's been very patient. He's been very much the team man on the fringe. Even though he's a senior bowler, he's been missing out. They have to play him, surely. Pattinson's... They're just letting Pattinson know that he's next man in, basically.
We'll talk about deep injustices when we get to Sean Marsh in a moment. But first, Steve O'Keefe. Steve O'Keefe's been brought in as a second spinner. I'm not anti this. O'Keefe's got a really good record at first class level, especially at the Adelaide Oval, where he's taken 18 wickets in his last 3 starts. He took 11 wickets in a pink ball day-night fixture there a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. It looks like he's the second spinner they're going to turn to in Sri Lanka next year and perhaps India the year after. He should be at the peak of his powers at age 30. Most spinners tend to be historically at their best around the age of 30. I think that's a really good decision, and it could be great the first decision. time we've seen tandem spinners play in Australia since 2006. So for those that like to see the tweakers getting a go, I'm quite buoyed by that.
Yeah, I'd like to see it. You know, we're not very adventurous with our selections. We've got a pretty boring way most of the time, and at least that would be something to talk about. And Steve O'Keefe's been pretty hard done by in his career. You know, he's been the best spinner in the Shield for years and years and years and just doesn't get a run. You know, play that one test match in the Emirates and got pulled immediately. So,
and missed out on Bangladesh too. He would have played in Bangladesh as a second spinner. I mean, he got picked ahead of Ashton Agar. Again, Agar is the long-term option, I think, but they're quite happy to leave him playing white ball cricket for the time being and develop as a player, perhaps as an all-rounder. I can see a world where Ashton Agar bats number seven for a long time in the Australian 11 at test level, but for the time being, they're letting him bash the door down, and O'Keefe seems the logical person to steer the ship for the time being, along with Nathan Lyon.
Yeah, well, that's right. O'Keefe's put in the yards already, basically, and Agar's a young, developing player, and he's, you know, he's batting strong, but his bowling is still a work in progress. So,
let's devote some real energy, Jeff, some real energy. Like, when Cameron Bancroft failed twice and they had to replace Usman Khawaja, and Steve Smith gave the indication that he might move back to three, I think we all in our heart knew what was going to happen. I think we all pretty much knew they were going to go to Sean Marsh.
We can pretend
we can make cases for other people, but in the pit of our stomach, it was always going to be Sean Marsh, wasn't it?
Only in that way, like something that you're afraid of happening, and then you're like, no, surely this can't be true. It can't be true. I just thought, no, they can't. They've done this enough times. Like, how many times does it have to seem like, oh, this is a great idea, this is the way forward? You know, you've got a guy who doesn't satisfy either criteria. When you're selecting, you can do two things. You can reward consistent domestic performances regardless of the age of the player, as per Adam Voges or Chris Rogers, or you can try to develop a youth player, you know, Cameron Bancroft at 22. Sean Marsh is neither. He's, 32, 33 years old. He's not going to be around for much longer, and he's never in his career delivered enough at domestic level to deserve being picked. He doesn't.
And these aren't even abstract things you're talking about, Jeff. You're talking about things like that directly were said by Rod Marsh, the chairman of selectors, not 2 weeks ago. This was the rationale he spelled out as to why Khawaja and Burns got the gig ahead of Bancroft and Klinger last time. He said, you know, and I quote, look at their first class averages, as blunt and irrational an instrument as that is for anyone who watches a lot of cricket. But that was his logic. Look at the first class average, and if they're even or close to even, we go with the younger guy. Now, I mean, yeah, sure, Sean Marsh isn't an old guy at 32, and that's not the reason to disqualify him. But that also, you've got to go to the measure of runs and consistency, which Klinger has him blitzed on. There's reasons not for picking Klinger as well. There's perfectly logical reasons why Klinger wouldn't be picked. But on the measures that Rod Marsh set, how could it not be?
Absolutely. You look at the Sheffield Shield last season, say. Klinger's second on the run scoring with 1,000 runs. Bancroft's third with nearly 900. And Cowan's fifth, right? Sean Marsh comes in ninth. He's a good couple of hundred runs behind any of those guys. That's last season. You know, this season, like Rod Marsh brought up the thing of batting averages. Now, I think it's ridiculous to say, look at a guy's career average.
But he did it.
I know. You look at his form in the last few years. That's what you do. But whatever recent form, this season, Sean Marsh averages 34 in the Shield. Klinger averages 91. You know, Klinger's first class average. Klinger's first class average, Rod Marsh, is higher than Sean Marsh's. It's 39.7 versus 38.5.
By the end of the Shield round, where Klinger got overlooked in Brisbane, his first class average actually was higher than Usman Khawaja's. Now, that's not the reason to pick Klinger.
No, it's not. It's irrelevant. But it's something that Rod Marsh brought up as a reason for not picking him. Now, if you're going to bring it up as a reason for not picking him, you've then got to pick him. If he's got the superior average, surely.
And you look at the reasons that Darren Lehman, when probed about this yesterday, his logic was this. He made 99 last year in Melbourne. Now, I add that Australia were 270 ahead when he came to the crease in that innings, batting for declaration. He said that he batted well in the West Indies. Again, he made two first innings failures opening to batting, and he made a half century in the second dig at Jamaica when they were already 170 ahead. Again, declaration batting. This is not the most challenging conditions when you're setting a target. And then he said he made a couple of half centuries in Sydney. That's just not accurate. He made one half century, he made one in the second dig. I mean, it's like they're trying to find any fig leaf to justify the selection when it just doesn't add up. If he goes out and makes 100 next week, then yeah, fair play to the guy and all the rest of it. But this isn't necessarily about the next two games. It's about how they develop this side in transition, as we said at the start of this conversation. Six retirements in the space of seven test matches. Do they see Shaun Marsh realistically as someone who's going to be able to win test series abroad for Australia? Well, having only made it to 20 balls 12 times in 27 test innings, the numbers would suggest not. There's a story in Crick Info overnight, which talks about how he consulted Chris Rogers about a more effective way of angling his bat against seam bowlers to nick off less. Maybe that'll have some contributing role as well. But I think that, you know, irrespective of what happens in the next couple of weeks, this is a broader conversation about how the team sets up for the future, and it's utterly bewildering.
It is about that, but it's also about consistency in selection, and it's about the ethics of what you need to do to deserve to be picked for Australia. And I think that's really important, because there are a lot of players who get shafted, who've been hard done by over the years for no good reason, except that the selectors have some gut feel or some inherent bias that makes them want to pick a kid who they like for whatever reason versus players who genuinely deserve to play. And on any measure versus three or four other candidates, Shaun Marsh doesn't deserve to play, and you shouldn't be angry at him. You should be angry at Rod Marsh and the other selectors.
In just wrapping up, Jeff, we've got the day-night test ahead in Adelaide. That's very exciting. I think we should be getting behind this now. Of all the criticism of the ball and all the hoopla about the various different elements to this which can be criticised, I think it's time that we double down and go, this could be restorative for Test cricket. They've done as much due diligence as they can. It won't be perfect. James Sutherland said as much, but it'll be adequate and passable and serviceable and all these other middling words. It'll be all of those things and more. and I think it's just time we just double down and go, this is good for world cricket. Let's embrace it.
Absolutely embrace it. And, you know, I may have seemed a little negative on a couple of points this episode. I'm very positive about the day-night test. If we get one of those evening sessions where it swings and we've got Southee and Bolt bowling and maybe they can hit their rhythm finally and actually pose some questions for the Australian batsmen for the first time in the series, that would be nice to see.
Yeah, slower track, which should suit them. The I guess the comparative advantage for Stark is softened somewhat there. A bit of momentum, dare I use that word, being carried into the test too after having a really good last 3 days. I don't know. Who knows? It could be a really interesting end to this test series. What we do know is the world's cricket eyes will be trained on it, because there's people coming out from all over the world to watch it. We'll definitely be there as well. Jeff, I think that's probably enough for us for today. This has been the Final Word podcast with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon. We'll talk to you from Adelaide in a couple of weeks.